Welcome to the Friday, November 9th, 2018 edition of the Clemson Dubcast. Tigers football team. Later today, we'll hop on some buses and take the ride over to GSP for the flight up to Boston. Going for fourth Atlantic division title in a row. Also shooting for the first ACC title in a row, but we won't talk about that now because other fish to fry before that game against some team from the crappy coastal division in Charlotte. Kind of an under-the-radar storyline. Wrote about this earlier this week. Tony Elliott and Jeff Scott, co-coordinators who had no previous coordinating experience when Dabo Swinney made the, I would say, much second-guessed decision to promote them after Chad Morris left in December of 2014. They are going for their 50th win in less than four seasons. Our research indicates no other first-time coordinator has racked up that many wins either side of the ball, offensive coordinator or defensive coordinator. So that is some really heady stuff for those two. And yet another example of Dabo's ability to identify coaching talent often within his own locker room. And we're going to talk about that more with Dan Wolkin in the podcast today. Our weekly video review segment is up at TigerIllustrated.com. We took a little deep dive into the importance of players being fresh late in the year. Kendall Joseph, a great example of that. He has 378 snaps through nine games. 2 years ago, at this same point, he had 569. That's an incredible difference. And you're seeing that difference in him and the rest of the defense. Also, guys on the offensive line who aren't playing nearly as much. They got a lot of tread on the tires right now, as Dabo told us earlier this week. Certainly one of the key themes of this season so far. Title sponsor of the Clemson Dubcast, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in Greenville. Very happy to have them aboard. Couldn't do it without them. Blake Smith and Brooke Archenhold, both Clemson grads, both huge fans. Forte of their firm is medical negligence. They represent patients and their family members in medical negligence actions. They also handle all sorts of other complex personal injury litigation. I can vouch for them. About 10 years ago, a family member had a pretty serious medical situation with one of the local hospitals, went to Blake Smith, and he very quickly and authoritatively gave us some great advice, and we were very thankful for that. Parham Smith and Archenhold offers free consultations. Give them a call, 864-990-4581 or parhamlaw.com. Also sponsoring the podcast is the Abernathy Boutique Hotel, right down about a block or two from the stadium. Great location. All the ESPN folks who are in Clemson at various points throughout the year, they stay there and they absolutely love it just because it's so convenient, so nice with all sorts of amenities, including the Taps Bar and Cafe. They also have a tailgate outside before home games and grilling out hot dogs, hamburgers, got a DJ, got multiple bars outside. They're partnering with Jack Daniels for those events. So a lot of cool stuff over at the Abernathy. Got a lot of good beers on tap inside at Taps Bar and Cafe. My favorite is the Hugie Street IPA. So go on over there and give them a look. Check them out right across from Lower Lot 2 or on the internets at theabernathy.com. Okay, our second conversation of the week on the podcast is with Dan Wolkin of USA Today. Been the national college football columnist for them, I think, since 2012, I believe. Really, really prominent voice in our college football conversation, also some college basketball stuff. If you haven't checked out his weekly misery index that runs, I guess, late Sunday night early Sunday, Monday morning. That's a staple of my reading every week. You got to check it out. Some really, I guess, funny stuff if you're a Clemson fan, because I think the Tigers might have set a record under Dabo Swinney in the streak of not being in Dan's misery index. It's been a long time since they've been included in that. So here's our conversation with Dan, learning more about how he does his job, sort of his routine, and also, of course, what he thinks about the current state of Clemson football. Enjoy. Okay, joined by Dan Wolkin of USA Today, national sports columnist. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
No problem. Thanks for having me on, Larry.
First of all, tell us about yourself. I think I met you. You were at the Memphis paper, the commercial appeal, and were covering the Masters way back when. I think I was the Augusta Chronicle. That was you, right?
So I was at the Memphis paper. I don't believe I covered the Masters for them. I covered the Masters 1 year when I was at Colorado Springs, I think way back in 2003. And that might have been it. I don't know if the timing matches up then.
That was it, because that was my last year there. Yep.
Yep, 2003, it was my first newspaper job. Colorado Springs, that was the year of the protests, the big Martha Burke protests about female membership. And so that was such a huge national story. And we had kind of a local angle because we covered the U.S. Olympic Committee so heavily there, since it's based in Colorado Springs. I ended up going down there and doing a whole bunch of stuff. And that was the first time I covered the Masters. Then I'm fortunate to cover it a little bit since then. But then I went to Memphis after that.
Okay. And you've been at USA Today since
2012. Got there in 2012 for the start of the football season. And so it's been kind of flown by. But seven seasons now of covering college football for them.
And I didn't realize previous to that, you were at basically an iPad newspaper interactive called The Daily in New York.
Yeah. So in 2010, toward the end of the year, I got a call from somebody who I had been connected with years earlier. I'd gotten to know him. His name's Chris D'Amico. He actually passed away last year, which is a total other story. But Chris was the sort of legendary sports editor of the Newark Star-Ledger. That's when I got to know him. And he had talked to me when I was real young about potential opportunities, and just never kind of worked out. Hadn't talked to him in a while. He calls me out of the blue and says, I've gone to work for this startup that's under the News Corp, which is the company that owns Fox. It's under that banner, and they want to do a publication that's native to the iPad. The iPad was sort of the hot thing at the time. And would you be interested in taking a look? And so I went up and we talked, and they wanted to make me the national sports columnist. And it was kind of cool. I mean, that's not the kind of job I would have gotten given my experience level at that time and in a whole lot of places. And so it was kind of a good fit. It was put me on a little bit of a different stage, and moved up to New York City, lived in Manhattan for a couple years, which was crazy, and ended up really liking it and just did everything. And ultimately it didn't make it, but I was better for the experience. And I was very fortunate that when they let us all go, that it happened to be at a time where USA Today was looking to kind of reset with some new people. And I knew those folks who were making the hires then, and it came together pretty quickly.
So college football is your primary area of expertise with USA Today, but you also do college basketball. And I think I remember you wrote some stuff on Tiger Woods when he won recently in Atlanta, correct?
Yeah, honestly, now I'm doing a little bit of everything. I mean, I have the title of national columnist. It kind of gives me a lot of latitude to look at different things. And if I want to write an NBA or NFL or whatever, I can do that. I also do, you know, some features and profiles and things. And I'm working on some interesting stuff right now. Obviously, Olympics has kind of been a tentpole area of USA Today for a number of years. And so I've been really fortunate to be involved in that coverage. Horse racing is kind of something I've picked up on the side a little bit. The last few years covering the Triple Crown, that's kind of been a kind of tentpole event for me. And then, you know, obviously with the breaking news and stuff on college sports, I spend a lot of time on that. So I do a little bit of everything. And I think, you know, I try to just kind of make myself useful wherever I can fit in.
Do you have any outside interest? I mean, it sounds like like, you know,
I have a lot of it. Yes. It's funny. It's funny that people who don't know me, that well, you know, just know me from, and I think this is true, by the way, of not just me, but a lot of journalists, and sports journalists, you know, sort of assume that kind of the only things that are going on in our lives are what we put on Twitter, right? Which, you know, obviously could not be further from the truth. You know, that's just sort of a small slice of the overall picture of somebody. And I do spend a lot of time on Twitter, and I spend a lot of time working, frankly. But, you know, I have a lot of outside interests. You know, I'm a tennis player. I travel around the world as much as I can. You know, I'm trying to learn Spanish. It's not very easy. I do a lot of time reading, you know, so a lot of different interests. I cook, love eating and cooking and all that stuff. So I stay pretty busy.
It just seems hard thinking about all the stuff you cover, and how much of a presence you have on Twitter. Like, how do you divide your time? I mean, I don't know. It just seems, seems difficult to shut it down.
It is. I mean, look, one of the things that's hard about being in this business, especially right now, is you're always afraid you're missing something, right? Or that something's going to happen that you aren't, a part of, right? A conversation is happening nationally that you're just not involved in. And that can be hard when you're used to doing that, or just because one of the reasons why people like me are drawn to journalism, drawn to the news business, is because we like being, you know, among the first to know about stuff, and we like knowing what's going on at all times. And that's a huge, huge problem to kind of disconnect from that. And I've gotten better about that, frankly. Of late, you know, I've made a conscious effort to do better. Whether that's, you know, if I go in, like, you know, I go in to play a tennis match, or something, you know, I leave my phone in my locker. I don't even bring it to the court. Because I just know if I do, I'll get distracted. My mind will start thinking, it'll be on something else other than what I'm doing. Right. And so I've gotten better about that. This past year, actually, I went on a vacation and went out into the Sahara Desert, went camping in the Sahara Desert out in Morocco, kind of on the border of Morocco and Algeria, and didn't have cell phone service for a few days, which is the first time, I think, like literally since I became an adult, that I haven't been connected to some type of events, type news, conversations, texts, Twitter, anything. And I thought it would be actually very hard to do that. And I found it refreshingly easy. So, it's something I may try to do more of.
And coaching searches, that's right in your wheelhouse. Is that fun for you? Is it stressful for you? Is it a little of both?
It is a rush for sure when you are in the middle of it, when you are, potentially working on a story that you feel like you're going to be the first one to have. That's a huge rush. It's also extremely nerve-wracking. And you do kind of at the end of it go back and wonder, like, you know, what am I doing? Okay, I'm going to try to break this story, and I'm going to have it 5 minutes before everybody else has it in the world. You know, what's the upside of that, right? But there is, I think, sort of an upside to it. There is not just pride in what you do professionally and being competitive as a human being. And I think I am pretty competitive. It's, you know, it's just a challenge, right? It's just kind of, you know, can you solve this puzzle? And a lot of times, like what'll happen in a coaching search situation is you'll get a piece of information that kind of leads you somewhere, but it's not the full picture. It's not confirmed. I mean, there's like, it's one thing, for instance, if, you know, you're, and you see this all the time, like in the NBA or whatever, right? Or college, like you'll see, you know, six reporters have the same, you know, tweet the same thing within 30 seconds of each other, you know, that some guy gets hired somewhere. Well, that's because somebody sent out a mass text, right? Whether it was, you know, an assistant coach or an agent or whatever, they'll send out, you know, the same text to at the same time to the eight people that they know and in the media, and they'll all tweet it at the same time. Which is there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, it's just part of what the business is on some level. But I do find the challenge of, I hear a piece of information and I just like start using every resource I have to try to hunt it down. And sometimes, you know, you end up with a dead end. But it's fun. It's kind of torturous. And especially for me, you know, it's hard because you know, at our place, I'm kind of, at least in terms of coaching stuff, I'm kind of a one man band. I try to spend some time on it. You know, ESPN has 15 guys who cover college football, and they're all sort of in different areas, and that encompasses a lot of different contacts, and there's a lot of information sharing that goes on, and so that gives them an advantage. That's part of a what they do really well. When they can throw those kind of resources at covering the sport. But we'll see how it goes this year. It's actually probably not going to be a huge coaching carousel. I'm actually writing something about that right now. So there may be less days where I'm just sitting there all day long texting people.
And you went to Vanderbilt Journalism School, correct?
Well, yeah, I went to Vanderbilt, but Vanderbilt doesn't really had a does not really have a journalism school. They have a newspaper, obviously student newspaper, and they have a sports writing scholarship that I won, which was named for Grantland Rice, the famous sports writer from the 1930s, and Fred Russell, who was the renowned sports writer for the Nashville Banner. So, those two Vanderbilt graduates, there was a scholarship in their honor, but there is no official journalism school.
A lot of big names have gone through there. Skip Bayless, Lee Jenkins, some others, right?
For sure. Yeah. Lee Jenkins was 2 years ahead of me at Vanderbilt, good friends with him. Spent a lot of time learning from him as well when we were students, and subsequent to that, Tyler Kepner at the New York Times, baseball writer, really, you know, one of the best baseball writers, maybe ever, just tremendous at that. And, Dave Scheinen at the Washington Post, another Vanderbilt guy who, really, you know, writes terrific stuff every time he tees it up. So, yeah, there's been a nice tradition.
It's interesting talking about coaching searches and breaking news and all that. Something I tell people is, in this trade, it's not like you go to a journalism school and there's a class on how to develop relationships to the point where you're getting news before anybody else. Is it, in your case, did you start to acquire that just cutting your teeth professionally, I guess, when you went to the Memphis, or I guess Colorado Springs and then Memphis? Is that how it went for you?
Yeah, you know, you're right. It's interesting that there's no real like way to do it other than just to work on building relationships with people. And, you know, how do you do that? You know, it's tough. And, you know, part of it is just like, you, at least from my view anyway, is, you know, people who are in position to have information or to potentially give you information, you can't treat them like they only matter when it's time to get information, if that makes any sense. I mean, it's just kind of a constant conversation that's ongoing over time, where there's trust that's built. And so that's one thing that I try to, you know, be mindful of and try to work on and continue to develop. You know, but there's also sort of a balance of, you know, some people don't want to like be bothered every day, right? So you've got to kind of know when to push, know when to back off. And it's interesting. And I probably wish that I had understood some of those dynamics better when I was like 21, 22, 23, 24. I only maybe started to figure that out a little bit later and kind of how to work on that level a little bit later. It's not easy. And that's why people like, you know, Adrian Wojnarowski or Adam Schefter, those types of people, you know, why they have a pretty unique skill set that has put them in position to, you know, be the guy that is the primary newsbreaker on their beat. You know, college football, I think, I don't know that there's necessarily one primary newsbreaker, but there's a lot of very good ones. And so, you know, like going into any, you know, big news story in the college space, you're going to be up against, you know, I mean, start naming people, you know, Bruce Feldman, Pete Thamel, Adam Rittenberg, Mark Schlabaugh. I mean, you're just going on down the line and they're all like really, really good. So, there's no free lunches.
What's your routine during the week during college football season? Is there a set number of things that you write, or you just pretty much determine that on your own?
Everything's been sort of up in the air, and you know, it changes. I mean, one thing that you can't do in this business, especially now, digital era, is kind of do the same things you've always done. That's just, it gets stale. People's habits change. Their interests and how they want to consume content changes. So you have to be kind of responsive to that. One thing that I have kind of discovered that works well for me is I go to fewer games than I used to, you know, kind of by design. I used to kind of go to a game, and if not every week, most weeks. Now, kind of the way I'm trying to do it in my role, and it's actually been quite successful just in terms of the numbers and things like that, are, you know, I stay home on Saturday and watch a bunch of games start to finish in the day, and then just kind of riff on what I saw, you know, what things stood out, and people seem to like that. So I'm going to try to do a lot of that. I'll go to a game, you know, every now and then. I'm actually going to Georgia Auburn on this weekend. And then obviously you go cover the big, you know, the really big ones, the playoff games and all that stuff. But I do the misery index every Sunday. That's kind of a routine. As long as people still like it and it seems like they do, I'll keep doing it. But other than that, you know, during the week, it's really just scattershot, you know, because sometimes I'm, you know, working on long-term stories and projects that, you know, require me to go somewhere and report and spend some time, you know, reporting and for a story that will run later. Sometimes it's a hot take kind of on an issue. And I don't mean hot take in a bad sense. I just mean like, and you know, whatever news story or issue is popular that day is getting traction. You know, you just kind of weigh in on it. And then sometimes it's a planned column, just, you know, kind of whatever comes to my mind. And then, you know, sometimes it's just making phone calls. So it could really be different every day.
You said people have shown they liked the observations you have from the games on Saturday. What metric do you use to, is it just analytics? You're able to see?
Yeah. I mean, like you're able to go in and see you know, how many people click on a story every day and how many people or what, you know, how much time they're spending on average with those stories. And, you know, I just think like one of the things that's pretty clear, at least, you know, in other places may be different, but for me, you know, kind of the game story is a little bit passe in terms of how people consume sports content now. You kind of got to do a little bit more something different than just your standard game story to keep their attention. And, you know, one thing about college football is there's so many games happening at once all day long. You know, people don't necessarily see or catch everything, but they want to know what's the big stuff, right? So if you can give them the big stuff in concise bullet points with some opinion and analysis, that's the kind of thing that plays well now.
Business owners out there, if you own a business that accepts credit cards, you need to listen up. Tandem Payment, based right here in the upstate, run by Clemson folks, is changing the face of payment processing, quickly becoming the most cost-effective solution for all small businesses. Tandem's program saves you up to 90% on processing charges and gives your customers what they love most, choices. This is not some crazy introductory offer. Tandem's technology allows business owners to offset their credit card processing costs by applying a small customer service charge to each sale they make. If you want to know more, visit TandemPayment.com today. Former Tiger Hot Rod McDowell works over there at Tandem Payment. They handle all their business and customer service face-to-face. So give them a call, 864-672-1570, if you're tired of spending an arm and a leg on all those credit card processing fees. So fascinating, Dan. You know, in the newspaper era, you know, the game is the biggest thing, you know, pre-internet. And so you had the Sunday sports section. It just blowout coverage of that game where in the last 10 years, the fans have watched the game. And so it's almost like their appetite by Sunday is for moving forward to the next game. And yeah, I remember when I joined Tiger Illustrated, I was like, why aren't we writing like 10 stories on this game? It was like, well, that's because people have watched it and they're moving forward. It's really interesting how that's sort of evolved over the years.
Well, it's just not hard to watch games anymore. You know, it's not that difficult to log in from your phone. You could be anywhere watching games. And so I think that plays into it. You don't have to necessarily tell people what happened. You kind of need to give them the why and what it means.
So pre-Twitter, how did you interact with readers, fans? Was it email, phone calls?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's almost hard to remember sort of what the world was like pre-Twitter, but you would get emails for sure. Twitter became a thing when I was in Memphis, and so I would get a decent amount of emails. The team I was covering was a huge deal, and everyone was paying attention to what I was writing. And so, the two ways I would hear from fans, frankly, would be through email, or like they would just come up to me in public. I mean, people knew who I was, so they would just stop me at the gym or in a restaurant or whatever and ask about the team. And, but yeah, that seems very sort of quaint compared to what goes on today.
Biggest positive and negative of today's conversation, being such a part of it on Twitter.
Well, I don't know that there is it's obviously just so easy to access people, right? It's easy now for people to think that they can talk to you, and it is, and that's good. But it's also a privilege that some people will take to an extreme, which is that they feel like they can say anything to you. And that's a problem. You know, that's a breakdown in civility that's a breakdown in, you know, kind of the standards people should have for themselves. Things people will say to you online through Twitter, it's made them emboldened in some cases, in a lot of cases, to feel like they can just be extremely nasty and personal and threatening. And that's, I mean, that's not just something we deal with. I think that's, you know, other kinds of media, actors, athletes, politicians. I mean, it's a problem, but it's not going away.
Yeah. It's not like if you walk into a restaurant or to a gathering spot, a park or something. It's not like you see everybody yelling at each other and calling each other douchebags. You know, people find right. a way to get along when they are there in person, but it seems like, having that, being able to hide behind a keyboard just brings a lot more nastiness, unfortunately. Dan, I recall you came to Clemson. It was Dabo's, the dinner that he hosts, over the summer, the night before his annual, golf outing. And I recall you being there.
Yep.
Standing in the kitchen talking to him. And I think that was your first introduction, to him. And I think I recall you walking away with a very favorable, take on him and his ability to take Clemson where it wanted to go. And back then, I think you were one of the few national voices who sort of picked up on it. Was that around 13, 14?
Yeah, it would have been, it would have been going into Taj Boyd's junior year.
Okay, so that would have been 2012.
Yeah, I mean, it might have been like right when I'm trying to remember here now that I think about it. Actually, I've got my computer out here. I'm going to look it up when that was. That was, man, it's funny how all these years sort of run together, right?
No doubt.
Yeah, I mean, I know, you know, Chad Morris was there. I played golf with Chad that's who Tim Bure paired me up with at the golf outing. You know, yeah, so it was around there, and I just remember coming away with the impression that it was a program that was on the rise kind of in a very organic way. And it was Larry, it was before the 2013 season.
Yeah.
It was when it was, because it was right after they beat LSU in the Chick-fil-A Bowl.
Yep.
That's when it was. I remember that now. So it's going into 13. You know, obviously they had won that huge game against LSU, and it felt like they were on the way up, but a lot of people sort of didn't buy in, you know, kind of nationally, that they were going to become, you know, a top five program or even close to it. And what I remember leaving that day, and I spent, I think, 2 days there, it felt different. The whole atmosphere around the staff, just felt very, very different than anything I had seen before or experienced. It was laid back. It was professional and laid back, but it was also like very, I mean, everyone talks about how they're a family in college football, and it's such a cliche. It actually did feel that way to me there. Like, I felt like, you know, the coaches were really good friends. You know, their families were really good friends. You know, that they enjoyed being around each other, that they, you know, didn't take all of this so seriously. It felt very comfortable. And to me, in my mind at the time, I was like, okay, now I understand sort of why recruits want to go there. I understand why they've gotten better in recruiting, and why, you know, more and more, you know, some top players are going to this program. And, there's obviously a lot of charisma with Dabo and all that stuff. It just sort of clicked in my mind. Like, yeah, this is going to be really, really good, when they finally break through. And, you know, they did pretty quickly after that. And, So I'm one of the few who's not particularly surprised by what they've done.
I just, we had a story yesterday that among first-time coordinators in college football, offense or defense, that Jeff Scott and Tony Elliott would be the first to get 50 in their first 4 years, and they're at 49 right now. You mentioned Chad Morris. I mean, he was a rock star here. I think you picked up on that, obviously. There was a lot of clamor when he left for SMU to, hey, why don't you just take that $1.5 million or whatever he was getting paid and go out and hire a proven, another rock star from the outside who's been through the wars. And then Dabo makes the very unconventional move to promote two guys who had no coordinating experience. There's also Brent Venables. I mean, Oklahoma fans were helping him pack his bags back in, I guess, after the 2011 season when he came here. Is that one of the I guess, main sort of strengths in your eyes of Dabo, that he's able to sort of spot these less than obvious choices in coaches who go on to be really successful?
Well, I think, and Dabo's talked about it publicly. I'm sure he's told all of you, you know, you guys, and I know he's told me. He likes to develop guys off of his own staff to be able to promote them when there's an opportunity and when they deserve it. I remember after Chad left, or maybe it was right before. I mean, it was obvious he was leaving. I don't know the exact timing. I ran into Dabo in New York City at the National Football Foundation dinner, which is literally two days after the conference championship games. All the coaches fly up there with their wives and hang out in New York. And I ran into him, and I just remember sort of asking him, like, yeah, if Chad leaves, like, are you cool? Are you going to be okay? Like, what are you going to do? And I mean, and he just, I just remember he kind of played it off like, this is not an issue at all. Like, I know exactly what I'm going to do, and these guys are going to be fine. And we're to the point as a program now where I can develop guys who I can promote guys we've developed, and like, this thing will not change. And so I think it says a lot about the culture of the coaching staff there, and you know, how well they work together, and how confident they are in kind of the direction that they were going in, and it's paid off in a big way.
What do you make of the entirely likely possibility of Bama Clemson Part 4?
Well, I've said this now for 2 years, and I might have been the only person in the country. I don't know this for a fact, but I might be the only person in the country who picked Alabama Clemson as the national championship game before last season.
Yep.
And obviously it wasn't the championship game. It was the semifinal. My thesis was then, and remains now, that there are a lot of programs in the country who can either recruit or develop extremely well. The only ones who are doing both extremely well are Clemson and Alabama. And thus, you can't be surprised when they are the two left standing. If you're the best at recruiting and the best at developing, that doesn't leave you a lot of room to get beat very often. So people may get bored with it. I think if the game happens this year, you know, it'll be in Santa Clara, California, which I think will be a major inconvenience for a lot of fans. And it's also just not a great place or venue to play a game like that. But it is what it is. And it will just sort of highlight how regionally, the sports kind of, even as it's been more national in interest based on the playoff, there is sort of this lingering danger about making it too regional, but there's just not a lot you can do about that.
Do you buy into the whole Bama-Clemson fatigue as a valid fear? I guess just from the national perspective?
I think Clemson less than Alabama. Alabama's been there longer and they've won more. But yeah, I mean, you do risk if the same teams, if it's the same, you know, four or five teams every single year that you know are going to win the whole thing, then it does, I think, turn people off because they sort of feel like, you know, what are they watching? The only place where that sort of works long term is the NBA. And the NBA is such a star-driven league that it doesn't matter as much. College football, you know, you do want to see a little bit more variety, I think, but I think you also have to respect, you know, the programs that are kind of on top right now are just doing it at an extremely high level, and you know, and that there are cycles, things shift. So I don't know how long this run will last for both of those programs, but I certainly think it'll be hard to displace either one from the national scene anytime soon.
Bama has been destroying people all year. Clemson has been destroying people recently. If they played today, how would you size up that matchup?
Yeah, I think the one thing that Clemson can do that other teams like LSU couldn't is Clemson can test them vertically. And that's the one area of Alabama's defense that is maybe a little bit more vulnerable or at times problematic, you know, is the back end of their defense. And so, you know, if you have a quarterback like Clemson does, who you really have to respect his ability to throw deep as well as those receivers. I mean, those guys are tough to cover. Then you at least give yourself a chance. And you know, the other thing you have to compete with Alabama is a pass rush, because Tua does and will make some questionable decisions when he's really under pressure. And you know, he doesn't always pay for it. I mean, sometimes he just flat out gets away with it. I mean, there, you know, you talk to coaches who've watched the film of the national championship game last year, and they're convinced there were, you know, two passes in the second half that Georgia should have picked off, and just didn't. And that, you know, that would have absolutely changed the outcome of that game. So you've got to get pressure on him and you've got to be able to throw deep. I think Clemson can do both of those things. Still, having said that, it certainly looks like a tall task to try to beat them right now, just given the pace that their offense is setting.
Yeah, and in 15 and 16, Deshaun's legs were so much a part of both of those games. And, I mean, Trevor Lawrence is not a statue, but he's not your dual threat menace that really is the type of weapon that typically is kind of like the kryptonite to a Nick Saban defense when you have a really elite one and an elite offense. Is that how you see it as well?
Oh yeah. I mean, Trevor Lawrence is a different kind of quarterback in a sense than what they've had recently. And I think they've made a nice adjustment in how they call it. And they're giving him an opportunity to be successful, but yeah, ideally if you're playing Alabama, you would like to have a quarterback who can make someone pay for their aggression, right? I think that's what it comes down to is, you know, if you're going to be really aggressive, somebody like Deshaun Watson, you know, can kind of just get you a little bit discombobulated because he can run the ball. And I'm not sure they have that with Lawrence. But, you know, also, when you look at the game last year in the Sugar Bowl, I mean, Clemson was right in that game until a couple, like, major mistakes, right? Now, if I remember correctly, one of them, you know, was kind of an offensive line breakdown that led to just a disaster. But, you know, going into the second half, early in that second half, I mean, it looked like Clemson was going to march down the field and, you know, score and take the lead. And then, you know, everything just kind of fell apart. You know, are they more ready for that this year? You know, we'll probably find out.
Is Urban Meyer at Ohio State in 2019?
Yeah, I think probably, but there's definitely been a lot of weird stuff coming out of Ohio State, and you know he's had to talk about his health and you know things in ways that indicate that there's at least some speculation out there that's getting to him about what's going to happen. I always say I can't see the future, but Urban burns out pretty fast. I mean, that's just been proven over and over again. And, if he walks away right after the season, I don't see how anyone could be shocked, just kind of given how it's all unfolded.
Back to Clemson for a moment. In the ACC, over the next 3 to 5 years, who do you see being able to present a legit threat to Clemson?
It doesn't look promising right now. Really doesn't. Florida State is just kind of a mess at the moment. And there's programs that, you know, kind of just have a ceiling. I mean, NC State's, you know, they can maximize what they are and they're not necessarily going to overtake Clemson over, you know, any stretch of time. You know, I had some hopes for Miami and the way they were recruiting, but you know, they're going to have to address their offensive issues. They're going to have to address quarterback. Mark Richt may have to give up play calling. You know, they're going to have a lot to sort out after this season, in my opinion. Virginia Tech, I certainly thought, and still think Justin Fuente is an excellent football coach. This year has kind of fallen apart a little bit on them for a variety of reasons. Maybe next year, a little more stability, a little more experience with some of their underclassmen, they can get that back. But yeah, it doesn't look right now like anyone is operating on the same level. And that kind of speaks to a near and medium term continuation of what we've already seen.
I mean, it really feels a lot like the 90s with Florida State when they went like, what was it, like 70-2 over their 9 or whatever years, their first 9 years in it. It just doesn't seem promising for the rest of the ACC right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, the ACC a couple years ago when they were so successful in the bowl games and when Clemson won the national championship, you know, there was a sort of narrative out there that everything was realigning and that the SEC was falling behind and that the ACC, because they had made all these great coaching hires, was going to overtake them. And, I sort of bought into that too a little bit, but clearly that's not the case. And, you know, I still think some of those hires were good hires, but you know, for whatever reason, the momentum just hasn't sustained and Florida State probably has a lot to do with that kind of collapsing. I mean, people forget like it, going into last season, they were the number 2 or 3 team in the country, depending on who you talk to or which poll you read. Right. I mean, they were that when they played Alabama, I was there in Atlanta, that was the game of the century, you know? And I mean, that it was 14, 15 months ago. Like it wasn't that long ago. Right. And now here we are. The ACC did, I think, overtake the SEC, but it was very, very fragile. And I think what's happened since then shows that.
If you're Clemson, does it even matter the prospect of the ACC being really bad if you continue to schedule rigorous non-conference competition like, you know, Texas A&M, Auburn, Georgia? I mean, that's where you prove your bona fides during the regular season. And then, of course, you know, in the postseason, should Clemson be worried about the prospect of a down ACC for a several-year stretch?
Well, no. I think in some ways, if you're Clemson, like, you want the ACC to be down. You know, if you're good and you know, you're going to schedule like they do out of conference, I don't know why it benefits you to have a tough ACC. Like, you're – if you take care of business, you're going to be in the playoff. And one thing that's that we've seen with the playoff in its short existence is if you're a conference champion that has zero or one losses, you're almost certainly getting in this thing. So that's the way the system's set up. Clemson now has the brand name and the reputation that helps their how they're perceived. So as long as they take care of business in the ACC, I don't really think it matters whether there's one more good team or six more good teams. It just, frankly, it just makes it an easier path.
So you think if they, let's say they lose at Boston College, which I don't think is going to happen, if they have that banana peel game, that they won't have any problem getting in as a one loss?
Well, I mean, there's certain situations where, yeah, you could get squeezed out. But ultimately, like last year, this is the flaw in the playoff. For everything that they like to say, we got it right every year, blah, blah, blah. The flaw is, if USC, for instance, took Notre Dame off their schedule and had instead played UNLV, they would have been, instead of a two-loss team, they would have been a one-loss team and a Pac-12 champion, and they would have gotten in over Alabama. I think the system, even though it says that it rewards strength of schedule, that's not really true. I think what it rewards is having zero or one losses, because most of the time there's not going to be five teams that have one loss or fewer. The herd just gets thinned out too much because of parity, and you go on the road and like Clemson last year, and you just get caught by Syracuse. Like, that just happens to everybody. So there's a scenario where they could get squeezed out, but I think even with one loss, the odds are they'll get in.
Well, Dan, I have successfully kept you off of Twitter for 45 minutes. Not sure if that's a record for you for this year, but I'll let you get back to your routine.
No, all good, man. Appreciate the chat.
Always enjoy your writing, particularly the Misery Index and all your columns. Really good stuff. So look forward to reading more of it over the rest of the football season.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. Okay. Appreciate Dan Wolkin sharing his time with us earlier this week. Really appreciate that. Thank you to our sponsors. Title sponsor, Parham Smith and Archenhold Law Firm in downtown Greenville. Also the Abernathy Boutique Hotel in Clemson. And last but definitely not least, Tandem Payment in Greenville. Thanks to all of you for making this part of your routine. Really appreciate it. The next podcast is set to be published on Monday morning, just as scheduled. So everybody have a great, safe weekend and enjoy the games. Cheers.